On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Rice University professor and author, Dr. Jeff Kripal.
One of the themes of the book is also this, I guess we could say, an indictment against science as we know it, materialistic science, science that insists not only that the paranormal doesn't exist, but that it's impossible. Tell us about that.
The thoughts we think and the worldviews we inhabit are determined by our cultures. And the reigning culture is this scientific materialism that essentially argues that we're only matter and that we can never get outside of our bodies and the particular historical context in which we find ourselves. And what happens, of course, to human beings all the time is that they have these sorts of extraordinary experiences that do seem to take them outside of their context, outside their bodies, even outside of space and time, which is how my artists and authors talk about it today. And so I'm simply pointing out that those sorts of experiences are dismissed or ignored because there's no way to fit them into the reigning paradigm. But once we just open up the paradigm, then they make actually a good deal of sense. You can't think yourself out of a box with the terms of the box. You have to find some other way to get out of the box.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we welcome back Dr. Jeffrey Kripal. You may recall last year when Dr. Kripal was nice enough to join me for an interview on his book, Authors of the Impossible, so it was really a pleasure to receive in the mail a copy of his latest book, Mutants and Mystics. Fascinating read. The interview is quite in-depth, so I don't think there's a need for a long introduction. Let's get right to my dialogue with Dr. Jeffrey Kripal. Today, we welcome back Dr. Jeff Kripal to Skeptico. Jeff holds a chair in philosophy and comparative religion at Rice University in Houston. He was a very popular guest when he joined me last year to talk about his excellent book, Authors of the Impossible. And he's back today to talk about his latest, Mutants and Mystics, Science Fiction, Superhero Comics, and the Paranormal. Jeff, thanks for joining me. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me back again.
Well, it's just my pleasure. And, you know, the first thing I just had to mention about this book and get it out there in hopes that other people will experience it is that it's just an absolutely beautiful book. I mean, the book itself, it's just... Of course, it's well-written and beautifully written, but the artwork, the graphics, the illustration, even the page layout, it all works together. To paraphrase Marshall McLuhan, you don't read this book, you get into it like a warm bath. I mean, it's just great.
Yeah. Well, we thought long and hard about all those issues, and the press responded with a lot of resources and a wonderful artist named Michael Brim who did all that. So, and he happened to be a comic book fan from his youth onward. So it all kind of came together.
Well, that's great. And you know, it's interesting that you mention your involvement of a comic book fan. And I've heard several interviews you've given on the book, and there is always this angle of the comic book fan or the science fiction fan, which might make our little dialogue here today, because I'm not a science fiction fan.
Okay.
Not a comic book fan. And I have to say that the book is great. I really love the book. But I wonder sometimes if the comic book science fiction angle, I know that's interesting to a lot of people, but if it somehow maybe takes things in a different direction, because this is a deep book, or maybe it's much broader than that. I mean, we're talking about spiritually transformative experiences, UFOs, alien abductions, consciousness, past lives, materialistic science. You know, the comic book angle and the superhero angle is there, but you're really trying to pull together a lot of stuff, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's two ways I talk about the questions I think you're asking there. One is, you know, is sort of a humorous autobiographical response, which is this is my midlife regression book. I sort of going back to my adolescence with this one. And so that explains the comic book sci-fi frame. But the other response, which is more serious, is it's a Trojan horse book.
Right.
I really do think I'm addressing or trying to address some really serious philosophical issues, but I'm doing it through popular culture. And so my hope is that the reader will pick up the book, see the pretty pictures, and get sucked in and let the horse in the gate, as it were. And then all these really weird ideas start popping out, and it's too late. The horse is inside the gate, as it were. So that's really kind of the rhetorical strategy of the book. But I'm also trying to make a kind of larger case that people's unusual experiences don't just occur in religious contexts or on a mountain or in an ocean. They also occur, believe it or not, through pulp fiction and through watching movies and doing art, that these things don't honor any of the boundaries we assume they honor.
Right, which is an interesting theme. And, you know, it's also interesting, this point that you make in the term use, this Trojan horse, because one of the themes of the book is also this, I guess we could say, an indictment against science as we know it, materialistic science. Science that insists not only that the paranormal doesn't exist, which is pretty outrageous, but that it's impossible. And for that, what I'd like to do is read a brief quote from the book and then maybe have you expound on that a little bit.
Sure.
We are essentially locked in and chained down to a worldview that does not seriously question itself, that by definition cannot question itself. How, after all, can one experience beyond matter in a world that claims there is nothing outside matter? And how can one step out of a worldview that says it cannot step out of a worldview? Hence, these sorts of paranormal experiences, which violate both our materialism and our contextualism, can only elude our grasp and frustrate our cognitively primitive attempts to understand them. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, basically what I'm trying to get at there is that, you know, the thoughts we think and the worldviews we inhabit are determined by our cultures. And the reigning culture is this scientific materialism that essentially argues that we're only matter and that we can never get outside of our bodies and the particular historical context in which we find ourselves. And what happens, of course, to human beings all the time is that they have these sorts of extraordinary experiences that do seem to take them outside of their context, outside their bodies, even outside of space and time, which is how my artists and authors talk about it today. And so I'm simply pointing out that those sorts of experiences are dismissed or ignored because there's no way to fit them into the reigning paradigm. But once we just open up the paradigm, then they make actually a good deal of sense, and they actually become really interesting and powerful experiences to take into consideration. But you can't think yourself out of a box with the terms of the box. You have to find some other way to get out of the box.
Right, but the paradox, and we'll return to this over and over again, is that that's what we're required to do. I mean, we're reading a book, so we are required then to kind of, again, that you maybe want to expound on this and talk about this human as two idea that recurs in the book and in your writing. Explain to us the human as two. I love this phrase of yours, human amphibian.
Right.
Explain what you're talking about.
Well, so the book came out of a series of interviews and a series of readings of artists and authors who create these forms of popular culture. And because, you know, most of them have lived in the last 50 years or so, they're all more or less informed by basic science, basic neuroanatomy, basic psychological principles. And a lot of them are very clear that when they had these experiences, these experiences were taking place in a place that was not in their normal sense of self or their normal psyche, that the experience was essentially one of being split in two, where part of the human being is outside of space and time, and part of the human being is in space and time. And so this phrase of mine, the human is two, is trying to capture that experience. They then take it further and get into various bilateral models of the human brain and talk about the left brain as this rational, linguistic, space and time oriented way of knowing, and then the right brain being this mediator of some other form of mind or consciousness that's not determined by reason and language and spatial and temporal categories. And so I'm simply trying to name what these people are describing in a way that can apply across the board as opposed to just to their particular experience.
Right, and let's apply it across the board, because obviously you have a rich scholarly background in religious experiences that speak to this, right? So all these transcendent experiences across culture, whether it's a Kundalini experience or a Christian, Catholic, a rosary experience, a meditation experience, there's just a variety of different transformative experiences that give us this very real sense of human as two. And yet the other theme in the book is this kind of balancing, or not balancing, because you can't balance them necessarily. You just have to kind of jump from one world to another. So any thoughts on that of this?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, again, the phrase the human is two is meant as sort of the balancing point, because, of course, the history of religion, the history of these experiences were usually understood to be some kind of God or deity or transcendent world intervening in the life of the person, where with these modern mystics, these authors and artists, they're usually suspicious of those kinds of religious projections, and they don't see these experiences as proving the existence of God, say, or of some heaven or some hell. They see these experiences as establishing that the human is two, not that the human being is experiencing God, but that the human experience of God is actually a human experience of some other aspect of the human being, that God is, if you will, a name previous cultures and eras have given to this other part of who we actually are. So this ends up effectively divinizing human beings, but not the social self or the ego, not what I call the Clark Kent aspect of who we are, but this sort of secret self, this sort of other side of us that peeks through very rarely, but fairly consistently throughout human history. So it's really a way of trying to humanize and bring down the divinity into human experience.
Yeah, I'm just not so sure we know enough about it that we can pull it down to that level. I mean, because the other thing I guess I pull out of that, this dialogue you have with the reader in Mutants and Mystics, and that's that there's a certain humility that I think comes from understanding the human as two. And it's a humility that is lacking in science and in a lot of cases in religion too. It's a humility that says, you know what, I have to acknowledge that we're just in the kindergarten playground here.
Right.
And we're doing something called, you know, consensus reality or consensual reality, where we don't know what's really going on, but we're just going to say this is what's going on. So can we really start saying those kind of things, that it's not a divine, it's a, you know, don't we have problems with the whole thing as soon as we try and wrap our arms around it? Don't we have to chunk it down?
Well, yes and no, Alex. I mean, obviously, everything you just said, I couldn't agree with more. And I'm happy you got that out of the book, because that is one of the messages I wanted to send, is that we need far more humility here and much, much less certainty. On the other hand, I think we it is a natural and positive human inclination to want to understand these things, to want to make sense of things that are part of our world. That's how science is driven, and I think it's how a lot of religion has been driven as well. And I think it's also true that a lot of the earlier religious explanations just don't work for us anymore. And I think acknowledging that and moving to some other kind of model is a perfectly healthy and perfectly natural thing to do. But that doesn't mean we then say, well, now we understand everything and, you know, everybody needs to agree that this is what's happening. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm, you know, arguing, as you know, much more for a kind of comfort level with chaos, which I think is what we see if we look up close at people's experiences and reports of these things, is they're often extremely strange, and they press at all of our categories. And I'm simply in the book trying to acknowledge that and then to offer some other categories, some other ways of speaking and thinking that can start to organize the chaos, and the human is too is one of those. But it's a very humble phrase. I mean, it carries a lot, but it leaves what that other part of the two is open.
Yeah, I love the way you put it in the book, and maybe you want to comment on that too. You say that you ask the question, is there a science fiction superhero meta-narrative? And might that help us bring order and meaning to people's lives? So expound on that a little bit.
Well, the book is an attempt to look at the last 100 or 150 years of early science fiction, and then pulp fiction, and then comics, and then film. And it focuses in on a set of what I call mythemes or mythical themes that appear over and over and over again. And all of these mythemes, or at least the first, three or four of them for sure, are really attempts to think about classical religious themes in scientific or parascientific terms. They're attempts to think through problems that in previous cultures would have been framed as religious problems, but today get framed in terms of I think science fiction and like the secret identity of the superhero and how he lives in the world with this secret identity. And so that's essentially what I'm doing. I'm looking at science fiction and superhero comics as sort of alternative ways of thinking about classical religious problems, but in more secular terms now, of course, because those are the terms of our culture. And so that's one of the things I'm doing in the book. Hence the title, Mutants and Mystics. Mutants are our new mystics.
Right, but now at the same time, I got to pull you back to the comment you made just before that, because you're also trying to pull out the reality or take some kind of scientific approach to looking at the reality of this. And I think that's where I want to come at this too. So you write at length about Philip Dick, a brilliant science fiction writer that many folks listening will probably be familiar with. And you look at his story as a narrative, which I understand where you're coming from. You bring a lot to it from that narrative perspective in terms of these mystic themes and the other points that you're making. But I can also look at it more just from a more concrete, scientific, spiritually transformative experience. And I can tell you, you know, I've had guests on like Hazel Courtney, who's had almost the identical kind of spiritually transformative, opening up, all-knowing experience. Or I could introduce you to Dr. Yvonne Kayson in Canada, who had a similar experience and went on to study spiritually transformative experiences through a number of people. And we could get down to really concrete stuff like, hey, eat sugar when you're having these kind of experiences because it'll ground you, or apply this certain breathing technique. So what about this kind of nuts and bolts, scientifically oriented approach to looking at these experiences versus the narrative? I mean, do we have to do both? But if we jump right into the narrative, do we maybe misunderstanding the physical reality of what's going on in these rather unbelievably spiritual experiences. Do you know where I'm driving at there?
Yeah, I think I do, Alex. Well, again, this is part of what I hope is my humility. I'm not a scientist. I don't do science. The book is not about explaining, for example, Philip K. Dick's experience of Valis in neurological or psychopathological or chemical terms. I mean, we can do that. Dick did it at length. That'll take us so far. What I'm much more interested in doing, because it's what I'm trained to do, is show how someone like Dick uses, say, modern cosmology or genetics or evolutionary theory or quantum physics as his framework for making sense of what happened to him. That doesn't mean that he knows his quantum physics or his evolutionary biology or his genetics or that I know any of those fields. It simply means that in the modern world, when certain kinds of people have these extraordinary things happen to them, they draw from the culture, from the cultural surround, whatever is useful or seems like it resonates with what happened to them. And it turns out that a lot of these people draw on physics and evolutionary biology to explain what's happening to them. And I'm simply trying to take that very, very seriously as a historian of religions. Now, again, what are the causal mechanisms? What's the biology or the chemistry of this or that?
But hold on, Jeff, because I don't want to go down the wrong path. I'm with you, and you do a marvelous job of that. But here's the gap. Here's what's missing, in my opinion, and that's that all those scientific, neurological, biological explanations are full of crap because they all are built from this apologetics of materialism, this denial that these things really happen. So they're really, in the ultimate end, they're just trying to explain it away. And I think there's something to be gained, and the gap is approaching these from a reality-based standpoint and saying, okay, these things really do happen. They right. transcend our, they cannot be understood in materialistic terms. Now, where do we go from here? One of the challenges, I think, is that the narrative as a jumping off point is this kind of pop culture perspective that you bring to it, which is wonderful in one sense, and in another sense, seems to be bound by the same kind of, you know, paradox that you draw right. out, that the right. culture, the pop culture, particularly popular culture, is both reflective of and driving at the same time culture. So it kind of becomes this mechanism that just is going to create nonsense kind of by definition, because we're in this, as we started with saying, we're in this materialistic paradigm that we can't get out of. So how do we fill that gap of saying, you know, we need a science to talk about these extraordinary kind of experiences that you're talking about?
Well, I think that's why you see these things celebrated in popular culture and not in conventional science or the conventional academy is, you know, for all that you're saying, and I actually agree with everything you just said, it's also true that popular culture is the realm in which the imagination in some way is the most free in our culture. You can say things in a science fiction film or a comic book or a novel that you simply can't say from the podium of the White House or from the podium of a graduation at a university. There's a kind of freedom there. And so what my artists and authors, I think, are doing is they're taking their experiences that cannot be treated seriously in these other contexts, and instead of arguing for them scientifically or arguing for them religiously, they're turning them into art. And that art then enters the culture, becomes fantastically successful in some cases, I would argue precisely because it's encoded with these paranormal events. Mm-hmm. And then that art then is a kind of feedback loop, flips back into people's future experiences. And so you have this really interesting feedback mechanism between the very private, very, very intimate experiences of the artists and authors, which then get turned into art, which then feed back into other people's experiences, and on and on and on and on and on. And that loop, that loopiness between what I call consciousness and culture in the book is really what I'm trying to drive at. And I'm trying to get away from this kind of simplistic, is it all true or is it all false question, which I think doesn't get us very far. So I'm not quite answering your question, Alex, but I'm just trying to rearticulate what I think the book is about, which may not be about what you're asking.
Well, no, I think it very much is. I mean, I think one of the reasons I guess I'm more passionate about these points is because the book really stirs the pot in a really interesting way that I think is going to provoke a lot of thinking among a lot of people on a lot of different levels, which is, again, you know, you are kind of reflecting some of the themes in the book indirectly as well as directly in the way that you're approaching them. And what you're talking about right there, I think, is fascinating, that maybe the pop culture is an end run around the institutions of science and religion in a way, right, of kind of reintroducing these ideas. Now, you also talk about in the book the possibility that there might be a different reality to that looping kind of effect than we would normally accept. I mean, that time isn't at all what we even think, and that the future, right, is creating the past in some kind of strange way that we don't understand.
Right. I mean, that's certainly what these authors and artists would want to argue out of their own experiences. And the sense I get from these people and these materials is that mind is not what we think it is. Mind is, I mean, certainly there's a form of mind, probably the normal form of mind, which is simply a function of our bodies and our brains and our local chemistry, as it were. But often or occasionally, or in these particular individuals, some other kind of mind beams in, as it were, and that mind doesn't appear to be constrained by temporal or spatial boundaries. And once you see that enough times, if you see it once, it's stunning enough, but after you've seen it a dozen or two dozen or 200 times in different individuals and correspondents and students, you begin to wonder about, you know, what our limits are as human beings. And again, that's where I'm kind of pointing with the book at the end, is what this really opens up for me is the question of what a earlier tradition or earlier era called the soul. We tend to think of the soul as this little thing that inhabits a single body and leaves at death, but that isn't what's being experienced here. There's some kind of supermind or cosmic consciousness that's creating culture and creating us backwards and forwards in time, because it's not even in time to begin with. And that's where you get into all these science fiction notions and all of these superpowers.
Give us some examples, if you would, briefly from the book that illustrate this point that you're making, because there's a lot of great ones in the book that this is not a theoretical exercise in terms of mutants and mystics. There's a lot of really concrete examples of people who've had these experiences and how they've affected their art.
Right. So, you know, one of my favorites is very kind of almost, well, really legendary comic book and fantasy artist named Barry Windsor Smith, who I grew up with as a kid in the early 70s. He drew Conan the Barbarian, and he sort of took the art of comic books to really a whole different level. And in 2000, or around the turn of the millennium, he published a two-volume autobiography called Opus, in which he talked about really the sort of paranormal background of his art in the early 70s that none of us knew about. And the experience that set these all off was It was a 3-year precognition. So what happened was he was literally drawing Conan the Barbarian in his parents' home in London in the early 70s, and he had a daydream, or what he experienced as a daydream, in which he saw these men and this woman in this office having this very distinct conversation, and he kind of forgot about it. And then the next day he was drawing a Conan page, and the page disappeared below him, and he saw this large white truck, and this traffic jam had appeared through the page, and he didn't think a lot of it. And 3 years later then, now he's now living in New York, he's drawing for Marvel Comics, and that exact office scene plays out, same men, same woman, same exact conversation. And then the following day, he hears all this honking, and he goes out and he sees that exact a white truck stuck in that exact same kind of parking mess. So that kind of time loop experience shatters what he can think of as reality, and that then initiates 3 months of these sorts of experiences, which involve all sorts of paranormal events, from sensing things on a couch that had been owned by someone to encountering light forms, all sorts of things, which he then again weaves into his drawing, weaves into his storytelling. You know, when people have this experience of a precognition, It's very ambiguous what's happening. You can say that person in the present is perceiving something in the future, but you can just as easily say that the person in the future is affecting a cognition in the present.
Right, exactly.
Right? Because of the nature of time and the violation of linear causality here, it's all up for grabs. We're in a total dark zone there about what's actually happening.
Exactly. And I think that gets back to a thing we were talking about before of humility. It immediately brings you down to a level of humility that says, gee, you know, I really have to re-examine everything that I think is real and all the assumptions that I'm making. And then I think it's particularly challenging when you refer to human as two, you know, it's a further splintering. It's a human as 3 or 4 or 5, because
right.
That other human has to deal with this nuts and bolts reality of our life and things that are going on and eating and sleeping. But it also then has to deal with these other forces that kind of push against our reality and say, oh no, this is reality, or science says this, or religion says this. So our culture, that is, as you talk about in the book, is splintering us further from this human as two, isn't it?
Right, because it's and of course we live in multiple cultures at any one time, so we're being told all sorts of things, and we're being written in various ways. And this is, again, is what part of what the book is about, is this the other really interesting pattern here is that writers and artists often have this experience that what they write or what they draw or create then plays out in the real world. And so there's this really weird connection between imagining something and something happening in the world. This happened to Philip K. Dick a lot, actually. And so the question is, again, to what extent are we authoring certain aspects of our world, and to what sense are we being authored or written by not some God, but by our culture, by our social world, by the language we speak? And how can we use that language and use that cultural world to not be written in such a clear way? Because we may not like the story we find ourselves in.
So why don't you share an example of that? I think that'd be interesting to folks, either from Philip Dick or the Planet of the Apes story is another one.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I open the book. The book opens with a comic book writer by the name of Doug Mensch, who's writing a Planet of the Apes story in the late 1970s. And it involves a gorilla named Brutus invading the human hero's home and grabbing his wife by the neck and putting a gun to her head and basically forcing the human hero to do his will. And Doug finished that scene and heard his wife holler at him from the other side of the house, and he went to see what was up, and there was a man in a hood, black hood, with his arm around his wife's neck with a gun to her head. And so essentially what happened was he imagined a story which then played out virtually verbatim in the real world seconds later. And this then had a profound effect, of course, on the author. He couldn't write, actually, for months, or couldn't write the same way because he was so afraid of fantasizing, which you can well understand. So there's an example. It's not, you can read that as a precognition that then gets filtered through fantasy and then plays out in the world, but it also speaks very powerfully to one of the themes of the book, which is that people's paranormal experiences are often very closely tied to language. There's something about language, there's something about words that carry these experiences a lot. And also images. And we know images are sort of right brain functions and words are left brain functions. And so these comic book writers and authors talk a lot about the power of the comic book genre is combining the image and the word and catalyzing these sorts of left brain, right brain symphonies, as it were. So I'm really interested in the book, as I was in Authors of the Impossible, about showing how paranormal experiences aren't just neutral experiences, that they often carry meaning, they often work through story, and they're often coded, really, by language itself.
Great. Well, then let's take that and that whole set of experiences and use that to segue into talking about UFOs and alien abduction, because as if it isn't enough that you tackle the whole spiritual experience, you also tackle, of course, UFOs and alien abduction, and you spend a good deal of time talking with, in the book, Whitley Strieber, who, of course, is best known for his books chronicling his own alien abduction. Right. Tell us what you think the tie-in is there.
Well, the book ends with a chapter on Whitley Strieber, and I use Whitley's corpus to sort of illustrate the themes of the entire book, because virtually every theme of the book can be seen in Strieber's corpus. Strieber is really interesting for a number of reasons. One is that, you know, he starts out as a horror fiction writer. He was a quite successful horror fiction writer in the 70s and early 80s, before he had his famous abduction experience in Christmas of 1985.
And let me just interject here, Jeff, because I'd love to get your take. You share your feelings about how horror really has a tie into religious, spiritual thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's a common misconception that religion is about the good. It's about being peaceful and good to each other, and holiness is some kind of state of equanimity and all good, all positive things. When in fact, if you look at the history of religion, if you even look at the Bible, a lot of encounters with the divine or the sacred are incredibly terrifying, often very dangerous, and sometimes actually deadly. And so the sacred is not just the good. The sacred is both profoundly attractive, but also often terrifying and destructive. And so horror, the modern genre of horror films and horror fiction, are calling up, I think, these ancient religious impulses. And I think the reason that horror is so powerful is that to get a profound religious experience, you somehow have to suppress the ego function. You somehow have to do something pretty dramatic to the person. Mm-hmm. And one way to do something really dramatic to the person, to get them out of themselves, as it were, is to scare the living crap out of them. because that's a form of, it's a form of ecstasy. It's a mild form of ecstasy. And so horror fiction often has these religious qualities to it. And I think that's why people, some people anyway, lots of people actually, like to go and be terrified watching a movie or reading a book. And so that, does that answer the question?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So let's get back to Whitley and the role he plays.
So Whitley was a horror fiction writer, and in the around Christmas of 1985, he had something very, very bad happen to him the evening of Christmas, 1985, and he then was extremely anxious, extremely upset, and he went to a psychiatrist actually to address this problem, and the psychiatrist treated it actually as a crime scene because Whitley had also been anally raped during this experience, and so the psychiatrist assumed a crime was involved, and to treat Whitley's anxiety put him under hypnosis, and what emerged was this very elaborate scenario of these strange beings that he calls visitors, who essentially abducted him. And so Strieber, a year later, publishes an autobiographical account of that event in a series of subsequent events, trying to make sense of all of this. And if you read the book, it's called Communion. It's probably the most famous book ever published on the alien phenomenon. The painting on the cover of this almond-eyed visitor really is what freezes the image of the alien into popular culture. This is 1986 now. If you read the book, though, and you read it closely, what you find is a very smart man doing some very nuanced things with a very traumatic experience that he went through. And essentially what he suggests is that something, in fact, was in the room with him, but whatever it was he imagined or saw in this hypnotic state he was in with his psychiatrist almost certainly is not what was there. In other words, Strieber's very aware that whatever was interacting with him, and it may well have been some aspect of himself, was acting on him in a violent way, but also in a transformative way, and it was engaging his imagination. And because he was a professional imaginer, a professional writer of fantasy, his experiences were quite elaborate and very sophisticated. And so, you know, reading Strieber and reading, he wrote four or five books after that, just trying to make sense of all of this, which he traces back to his childhood. He traces it back to some childhood trauma that he went through, perhaps on his father's military base. He speculates at length about all of this. But he always leaves the question open about the status of these beings that he encountered. And you get the sense, if you read enough of Strieber, that he doesn't think of these things as out there in any simplistic sense. He also thinks of them as in here. And so again, you get this theme as the human is two. And you also get a profound sense from Strieber that this is what a religious experience looks like if you live in a science fiction worldview as opposed to a Roman Catholic one or a Buddhist one or a Hindu one. So he's very aware of the role of the imagination and the role that he played in it as a professional writer, but he also insists that it has some greater reality to it as well.
Right, and that's the challenge, I think, Jeff, that I keep bumping up against, because on one hand, you know, in the Authors of the Impossible book that you previously wrote, that was another fantastic book that I'd encourage anyone to get out and read. Great book. You explore the writings and the research of Jacques Vallée, who
right.
is a UFO researcher, who's one of the first to kind of draw our attention to maybe the larger paranormal or spiritual context in which these UFO phenomena occur. So he said, hey, you know, if you're just looking for spaceships and little green men, you're not looking in the right place. You need to look right. also at ghosts and fairies and all the other stuff out there. So right. I get that. But to diminish these experiences to just that, which you're not doing, but no. I think also loses part of the story. And I think while Whitley Strieber is certainly saying that, hey, maybe it is by definition more than I can fully comprehend or tell you about in some story, it is still, there's some reality to it.
Yeah.
You know? So are we drawn to that, or are we drawn to the, or not, do we focus on that, or do we focus on the declassified secret government memos that researchers like Richard Dolan publish, who say, here they are, here it is from our highest military officials in the 1950s saying, yeah, we saw him, we went to shoot him down, so that there's a reality, a physical reality to this that we have to deal with too, and we have to somehow then try and understand. You know, another researcher, and the name escapes him right now, but points to that not only is there this physical reality that we've known about, but that the government from the beginning has understood the consciousness effects that are part and parcel to this, and
right.
that he traces that, hey, immediately, what did they start doing? The MK Ultra up in Canada. He said, well, if these visitors can somehow control our mind or control the mind of people that they encounter, we need to know about that. Let's go start doing mind control projects of our own. And that feeds into MK Ultra and has its origins in the remote viewing project and all the rest of that. So again, back to the theme we're talking about with the spiritual is there's a reality there that we have to balance in terms of understanding this stuff.
Right. And so the mantra of the Mutants book is it's probably both and not either or. I mean, this is where it gets so mind-boggling. You can look at the UFO phenomena. You can look at the military records, you can look at, you know, the government stuff, and you can get this sense, okay, these are objects flying around in the sky. But you can then also read the actual human encounters, the abduction literature, and then it looks very much like these are not spaceships, these are, you know, some kind of paranormal encounter that's getting framed in science fiction Cold War terms. And what we probably have is all of that. You know, I mean, Whitley's abduction experiences took place, he himself would be the first to say, in a Cold War environment in which he had grown up on bad B science fiction movies. I mean, I've heard Whitley say point blank that if we had better science fiction movies, people would have better abduction experiences. And the reason his experiences were initially so negative had something to do with the Cold War era in which he was raised. So there again, there's that both and. He's not dismissing his experiences. He's not reducing them to politics or to simple projection. He's saying that it's all woven together. And particularly with the UFO stuff, what the problem with the UFO stuff is that it's a huge grab bag. I am virtually positive that some people's sightings of UFOs are sightings of our own secret military technology. I mean, why not, right? I am also convinced that some people's encounters with UFOs and are essentially these sorts of religious experiences that I'm talking about, right? I am also very certain that some UFO encounters are purely fraudulent, made up for disinformation reasons or people just screwing with us, who knows? And all of that stuff gets thrown into this grab bag called the UFO, and it all gets confused and it all mixes around and it all influences each other. And that's why we have the mess we have with it. We don't understand, because we're putting all of these things into the same basket, probably because they are related in some way that we don't understand yet.
Right. I just have to throw in one other category there. I'm very persuaded that some are experiences with a technology that is far beyond what right. we could possibly imagine from our current technological capabilities. And particularly if you look at ones that are 50 years old and traveled at, you know, 40,000 miles an hour and turned at right turns and those kind of things, which you have pretty good documentation on. So and it only takes one of those to, you know, right. upset the whole apple cart that we're
right.
talking about. And I guess there's one other aspect of this that I'd like to draw your attention to in the time that we have and get your comments on. And that's that, and I guess I've touched on this before, but in both these cases of the spiritually transformative experiences and the UFO alien abduction experiences, there is also this resistance that maybe even goes to the level of deliberate deception about our understanding of that reality. So we talked about the end run that pop culture can do on this, and I think you do a great job of exploring that and showing the different dimensions of that and how it works. But what if another part of our kind of here and now reality is that we are intentionally being misinformed about this
yeah.
and being kind of distracted and deceived into thinking that it's not true. And what we've focused on most in this show is how that's just definitely happening in the paranormal, parapsychology, and spiritual realm, where, you know, any research that suggests that, for example, prayer might be efficacious. Well, you know, it's derided and dismissed or neuroscienced away, and the same with out-of-body experience or near-death experience or mediumistic experiences. There's really an organized effort to kind of send us in a different direction. What are your thoughts on that?
With respect to the UFO stuff, or with respect to the whole
because I think it's another case where I don't know what the ultimate truth is. Some of it's obvious that our materialistic science is reflective of our materialistic
right.
culture, and that the whole machine doesn't work unless we all are kind of believing in
right.
that. So that could be a reason why when UFOs pop up, we get this disinformation. When spiritual experiences pop up, we get this disinformation and this denial kind of stuff. And some of it's just genuine disagreement, but some of it seems to go
yeah.
beyond that and to a level that, you know, there's this real effort to misinform us about these things.
Right. So two things. You know, one of the themes that I talk about in the book is the paranormal is screwing with us, right? Particularly through an author named John Keel, who pushed that very far. So I would say two things. I would say that a lot of these experiences that you're talking about that sort of border on a kind of paranoid worldview or a conspiracy theory, I think have a kind of exaggerated form and a kind of fairly accurate form. So the accurate form, I would put this way. Each of us, to the extent that we are limited social egos operating in this immense cultural environment, for the most part, we are not in control. We are being written in ways that we can only begin to fathom. And by that I mean in very simply, I don't mean by aliens or the government. I mean by the language we speak. I mean by the culture in which we live in. I mean by the religions that we profess and practice. All of these things write us. We are written. We are not writing ourselves. And so this notion of a conspiracy or being this notion of a kind of paranoia, I think is getting at something very real and very profound. To the extent, though, that it then gets literalized and people start talking about the government keeping aliens frozen below military bases and signing contracts with aliens to experiment on human beings, that's where all my red flags go up. And I say, that's too far. You've just crossed the crazy line.
Okay, maybe. And there's this crazy line out there, okay? But really, Jeff, I mean, I take the first part of what you're saying, and that's really what I'm getting at, is that, you know, so we have Richard Dolan, and we have the memos, right?
Right.
So we know there's a reality to the cover-up, to the conspiracy. It's plain.
Right.
It's
plain.
So how far we take it seems to be less of an issue to me than the fact that we don't deal with the reality of the cover-up. You know, in the spiritual realm, you talk about, of course, William James, who, you know, you talk about conspiracy. I mean, it was clearly an organized effort to suppress his thoughts and his ideas and to make them less prominent among the psychology community, because
right.
he was the most prominent psychologist. So, you know, I think I get my red flags go up when anyone wants to talk about the crazy line and draw it here or there. I think we first have to deal with the reality of the conspiracy, the reality of the deception, to the extent that we know it, and then we can start defining where the crazy line is.
But Alex, me included, we all have a line which we won't cross for a variety of reasons. Some of them good.
For a lot of cultural reasons that you just talked about too, right?
Yeah, and I'm simply admitting where my line is.
I hear you.
I'm not... I'm not saying that the government never keeps secrets from us, or that the military hasn't done everything to sort of squash our knowledge of the history of UFO sightings. I'm fine with all that. That's one thing. But some of the conspiracy theories that float around there, they just take it so far, and they look to me like religious claims, not strong empirical claims. And again, not that I'm bound to some kind of empiricism. It's just that's where my suspicion goes. And part of it, too, is, you know, I belong to a large institution. I know how institutions work. I find it truly impossible that an institution as large as a nation state can keep such things under wraps for so long. I'm suspicious of that. But again, not that we're not told everything. I know, I understand that. The fact is, most nation states have released their UFO records. We're the real exception here. I just think we have to be careful in this zone, because there's so much disinformation floating around, there's so much fraud, and there's so many genuine encounters that have traumatized real human beings, and it's all mixed together. And that's what all I'm trying to say. And that's what the book was trying to show, is that not only do we have disinformation, fraud, and real encounters, but then we have popular culture, which is informing all of that, and which is informed by all of that, and which in some ways glues it all together in our culture. And so we're inhabiting all of this complexity all at the same time.
You know, that's such an interesting point, and I won't get into it because we're running out of time, but I think that whole dialogue feeds back in this recursive, circular kind of way that is really drawn out in the book. Again, the book is Mutants and Mystics, Science Fiction, Superhero Comics, and the Paranormal. Jeff, it's just a tremendous effort, and I appreciate so much you coming on Skeptico to talk about it.
I'm honored and delighted to be here, Alex.
Thanks again to Jeff Kripal for joining me today on Skeptico. You know, there's a couple of interesting themes from this interview that I'd like to tee up for a discussion, either in the forum or on the comment section of the website. And the two are this. The first is the power and the value of the narrative. One of the things that comes through again and again in Dr. Kripal's work and continues to ring in the back of my head in so many conversations is this idea of the narrative, the power of the narrative, the importance of the narrative, and how often in the hard sciences, if you will, or just in science, we have a tendency to want to dismiss or undervalue the narrative. But when we really look at culture or anthropology, sociology, or folklore, or from a number of different angles, even within science, we see the importance of the narrative in how we as human beings understand our life. So I think Dr. Kripal is wise to point out the value of the narrative, the importance of the narrative, and in this case, where the narrative is taking us in terms of these very hard to understand experiences. So let's talk about the narrative and whether it has a place in science. And the second theme that I think I'd like to discuss, which is really, really quite different from the first, is the crazy line. I thought that was very interesting at the end of this interview, and I agree with so many of the things that he has to say, but I really have to take issue. I think it's such a great point, this crazy line, and we all have the crazy line, and where we draw the crazy line. And if anything, what my experience with Skeptico has taught me is we have to be very careful where we draw the crazy line. And you better suck in a lot of information and hear from a lot of divergent views before you're quick to draw that crazy line. So the question would be, how do you set a crazy line? Do we need a crazy line? And where do you draw your crazy line? So those are just two possible areas. Of course, we can take this dialogue wherever you want to go. We'll just do that on the Skeptico forum or on the website or by dropping me an email. You can find out all about that stuff at the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. And there you'll also find all our previous shows and the email and Facebook link to me, link to the forum, as I was just talking about. We'll have a number of interesting shows coming up. There's no slowdown in the summer season here at Skeptico. So stay with me. Much more to come. Until then, bye for now.